KPCW News time is 8:06. As I mentioned before, it's a chilly 24 degrees or so here in Park City. I know they started running the snow guns the last couple days at the resorts. What do we got coming up? We've got Nate Larson with ABC4 to tell us.
Yeah, Roger, happy Friday. We do have cold enough temperatures. I've seen the snow guns as well on the webcam. It's nice to see that snow starting to fly. Man-made, I guess, if Mother Nature's not delivering just yet. We do have a few systems, though, that we're tracking. One arrives this weekend, another one next week that'll bring some snowfall, even to Park City, not just our higher elevation. So highs today rebounding from the mid-20s to upper 40s for Park City. Plan on some high clouds sticking around. Otherwise, quite a bit of sunshine. It's going to be a really nice Friday, about 48 for the high. Overnight lows back down to the low 30s, about 31. We have moisture moving in Saturday afternoon. Plan on some showers, rain initially with a high of 46 on Saturday afternoon, over to snow into Sunday. No winter weather advisories or anything issued just yet. It's looking like Park City, though, could pick up around 2 to 4 inches of snowfall on Saturday night into Sunday. Looking at highs just near 35 on Sunday as well. Partly cloudy on Monday. We get a bit of a break. Might see a stray shower or so. Temperatures still in the mid-30s with the next system pushing in Tuesday for Election Day. Overnight lows will be near 20 degrees, so it's going to be cold. And highs near mid-30s again on Tuesday. Plan on snow showers Tuesday into Wednesday. Partly cloudy sky. Should see decreasing moisture Wednesday afternoon. Not much change temperature-wise until Thursday. We bump up to about 40 degrees. Overnight lows could be in the teens, though, by the time we get to Wednesday and Thursday mornings. Heber looking at 54 for the high today. Some high clouds, otherwise lots of sunshine. Overnight lows in the mid-20s. Plan on mostly cloudy skies on Saturday with increasing shower activity in the afternoon. Low 50s for highs. Back to 26 into Sunday morning with snow showers expected. Could see an inch or so accumulate in Heber with 41 degrees on Sunday afternoon, possibly just a wintry mix. And then break on Monday with more snow pushing in Tuesday into Wednesday. Temperatures will be near 40 for highs. Overnight lows in the teens will clear out on Thursday with mostly sunshine taking over with a high of 46.
So, Nate, as you mentioned, they're going to have to make some snow if they're going to open the next few weeks. It sounds like that week forecast, this week's forecast, is going to be pretty good for snowmaking. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's going to be cold. And even the 8 to 14-day outlook, so looking into the extended forecast, still shows likelihood of having colder than normal temperatures for much of at least the state. At least that was the latest run. Should continue to see some of that continue.
Yeah, if we can keep that up for the next few weeks, they'll be able to open
something.
Be open
for Thanksgiving.
Yes,
yeah.
Sir. That's what we hope
It'll
for.
Be fun.
Nate, have a good weekend. Thank you, sir.
Yep, you too.
This is the Local News Hour. I'm Roger Goldman. Coming up, we got an interesting show today. We're going to be speaking with Joey Granger, the Wasatch County Clerk, about how the county is handling the 2024 election. Then we're going to be speaking with U.S. Forest Service PIO Brian Trick. He's going to be talking to us about the Yellow Lake Fire and, more importantly, the aftermath. What happens after a fire to sort of mitigate some of the damage? We're going to finish our hour by speaking with North Summit High School football coach Jerry Holmes and Wasatch High football coach Jody Morgan about the playoff games that each team is going to host tonight. Please stay tuned. Two men are in custody after state troopers say they found them trafficking a family from California to Indiana along Interstate 80. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports.
A Utah Highway Patrol trooper's report says he stopped the car just before Colville on East Interstate 80 last Saturday. There were five people inside, two men and a family of three. Troopers say they suspect the men were trafficking the family for labor. No additional information was provided about the victims. During the traffic stop, the driver allegedly told law enforcement the car was not his. Arrest documents say license plate and registration data showed it traveled 45,000 miles in the past 2 months, a pattern consistent with human trafficking. Troopers say they received verbal consent to search the passenger's phone, where they found texts from a third party promising payment when the family reached Indiana. The driver was arrested on suspicion of human smuggling, and his passenger was arrested on suspicion of conspiring with them and benefiting from the smuggling. Neither man had been charged as of Thursday. They are being held in the Summit County Jail without bail. Authorities say they found multiple human smugglers in the Wasatch back during traffic stops this year. Most were traveling through Utah to another state. During a two-week period in August, two men were stopped in separate suspected smuggling incidents in Heber, and the month prior, three kidnapped Iowa girls were found at an I-80 rest stop. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
With the 2024 general election just days away, KPCW's Grace Dorfler has an update on spending by Wasatch County School Board candidates.
Six candidates are in the running for three spots on the Wasatch County School District Board of Education. All races are nonpartisan. Candidates submitted a first round of financial disclosures in early June, and another set was due October 29th. The records were made public by the county clerk's office Thursday. Brad Ellert and Tom Stone are competing to represent Midway families. Ellert bought about $2,600 worth of mailers and signs using his own money. Stone is running the least expensive campaign. He reports he hasn't had any campaign expenses. Incumbent Kim Dickerson and challenger Randall Lund are running to represent the eastern side of the school district. Dickerson has spent about $1,900, mostly donated, on campaign mailers. Lund is running the most expensive campaign of the six candidates. He spent over $5,600, much of it his own money, on expenses including mailers, posters, and yard signs. Incumbent Marianne Allen and Brianne Dietrichson are vying to represent the southern portion of the district. Allen has bought around $1,400 worth of yard signs and digital ads. Most of that money was donated. And Dietrichson paid $2,500 for campaign mailers. Full details on candidates' campaign disclosures are available at kpcw.org. The general election is November 5th. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Park City School District hosted a panel Tuesday to share how reports of bullying and harassment are being handled. KPCW's Christine Weller reports the event was in response to a federal investigation.
Federal regulators concluded an investigation into the district in March, finding over 180 incidents of harassment and discrimination in Park City schools. The district then entered into an agreement to resolve the investigation. Since then, the district has taken steps to remedy the harassment incidents and foster a greater sense of belonging in its schools. During a panel discussion Tuesday, district and school leaders shared how the new reporting and documentation process works. The district expanded its Student Services Dean's program, so each school has an administrator dedicated to investigating student behavior issues and ensuring compliance with district, state, and federal policies. The deans originally assisted elementary principals with administrative tasks. The new dean at Trailside Elementary, Jessica Jaeger, said when a report is submitted, the first step is to stop the bullying or harassment.
We immediately determine, are there any preventative measures that we need to put in place to make sure that while we're investigating, whatever has been happening stops? So that could look like a no contact order, that could look like additional monitoring and supervision during unstructured times like lunch or recess.
Deans then alert parents about the bullying or harassment allegation and begin an investigation. Reporting students and any witnesses are interviewed first, followed by the alleged bully or harasser. Parents are then advised about the outcome of the investigation and any resulting consequences. Jaeger said deans will also provide recommended supportive measures, like small group counseling covering conflict resolution skills. Trailside Elementary Principal Tracy Fike said one of the dean's most important jobs is documentation of harassment and bullying investigations. Lack of consistent documentation was one issue identified in the federal investigation.
One of their really important roles is the documentation of that, to really ensure that we're following all of the processes we have set in place to do a thorough investigation and really communicate back to all the parties involved.
Jeremy Ranch Elementary Principal Sean Keenan said the online reporting form is a great option if students don't want to speak to a school official in person.
There's a host of reasons that the children might be too afraid to bring up any sort of bullying or harassment problem with anybody but their parents.
Online reports are sent directly to deans and other school leaders. A video on how to make an online report can be found at kpcw.org. The deans work alongside other administrators and the Title IX Internal Compliance Office, which handles sex-based harassment. The district has also implemented initiatives and resources to prevent bullying and harassment. For example, McPullen Elementary Principal Angie Duffner said full-time counselors provide monthly bullying prevention lessons for students. The district previously launched the We All Belong campaign to foster greater bonds between students and the community. This year, local administrators also passed policy changes to set rules for acceptable school behavior and train staff on how to investigate and resolve incidents. Also new this year is free online mental health resources for students, families, and staff. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
It's a busy time for county clerks around the state as mail ballots are being returned, property tax notices are going out, and voters are going to be looking to hear results of elections at all level. Here to talk about the election process is Wasatch County Clerk Auditor Joey Granger. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Joey, let's start by explaining the role of the county clerk in the elections process.
Gosh, there's so much that we're in charge of. So the role starts with the beginning of voter registration. So maintaining the voter rolls and providing, you know, information and the ability for everyone to keep their information up to date with us. And then, of course, that goes into providing ballots, collecting them, making sure they're secure and counting them and getting accurate results to everyone in a timely manner.
So Wasatch County has experienced a lot of growth in population in recent years. How is that reflected in the voter rolls? Have they grown substantially?
Yeah, I'd say they're growing, but they're also, there's a lot of turnover still. So we do have a lot of people that, you know, they come and then they go. And so we're not really seeing a huge influx, if that makes sense. Mostly just a lot of change. I think we're probably 10% more in voters from when I started 4 years ago.
That's interesting because, you know, you have the sense that Wasatch County in general and Heber City in particular is just booming with new residents. So, you know, it's interesting that you were only seeing about a 10% increase. Do you have a sense of how many voters that the new registrants are new residents as opposed to existing residents who are simply finally getting around to registering?
No, I haven't been able to dig into that.
Mm-hmm.
That is definitely something I would like to get some information and report on. Like I said, there's so much turnover. I'm sure that the growth is mostly new registration, obviously, but we have seen some new, you know, the 18-year-olds
mm-hmm.
freshly graduated. We do have some classes that are doing pre-registration, so that's a good sign.
And there are a lot of ways to register in Utah. I mean, how is voter registration linked, for example, to driver's licenses in Utah?
So the driver's license division does provide a registration form at the time of, you know, getting your new driver's license, which what happens is it uploads straight to our system. And they've basically already done all of the work verifying citizenship and residency there. So that is very helpful for us because it just comes through. We make sure that registration form is complete, and then we upload it, and they're marked active in our system at that point.
Now, earlier you mentioned something I know a lot of people are concerned about, which is maintaining the security and the integrity of the process. Can you talk a little bit about how the process of receiving and then counting the ballots works in Wasatch County?
Yeah, so all ballot collection requires two people at all times. All ballots have to be either, you know, under camera security and with two people. So collection for us starts basically a day or two after ballots go out. We open up all of our ballot boxes. We also have a plan with the local post office where we go and we collect from them directly. So the ballots at that point don't ever leave the post office with a postmaster. They're not, you know, roaming around town in somebody else's vehicle. We actually take custody straight from them. And then at that point they come to our office, we log them. They get counted twice at that point, logged in with us, and then they go behind lock and key until we're ready for judges to come in and do the signature verification process.
So right now, I assume there's room under lock and key where a number of ballots are being held. Is there any tabulation done yet, or is that process won't start till later?
So we haven't in our county started. I know some of the bigger counties, well, a lot of the other counties have a little bit different processes than we do, but we've been trying to make sure that we're caught up on receiving, giving the vote history, letting people know that we do in fact have their ballot. And we are to the point now where we have separated ballots and we can start processing and tabulate.
And you just mentioned something important. A lot of people, particularly in this day and age, are concerned. They put the ballot in the mail. How do they know that you got it? Can you explain how Track My Ballot works and how long it typically takes from the time someone would put their ballot in the mail until it shows up on Track My Ballot?
Well, this year we did get a little bit of a late start. So people were getting, you know, they got their notice that their ballot was in the mail or whatever. And there was probably a week and a half delay between when they received it, dropped it off, and then when we received it. I don't know if that makes sense. When we received it, we could have had it in our possession for 2 or 3 days before we actually uploaded to the system to let them know we received it, because we were more focused on making sure we were collecting them, getting them batched, and getting them under lock and key before our judges started. So we can't give vote history until we verified that signature, and then we upload it into the system. So there's a little bit of a delay in the process. If we were full time and we started that same day, we could do that same day. But anyways, ballot track basically gives you a notification. If I log in our system that night, that information is updated for the voter, and they'll get a text message if they've signed up for that service saying it's now been received and counted.
Now, yeah, that's an important point, because I know in casual conversation, somebody mentioned to me that they'd mailed their ballot a week ago and it hadn't shown up yet. So the fact is there was a bit of a delay, but it sounds like you're catching up.
Yeah, we processed in the last 2 days, we processed about 8,500 ballots.
Which is quite a bit in the county of that size. Okay, so the ballots are there, they've been processed. Are they starting to be opened and going through the signature verification process?
Yeah, so that part is done. That's what we've actually processed. Okay. They're open now and separated. About 8,000 of them have been separated, ready for tabulation.
And how does that signature process work? Who does that? Is it electronic or human beings actually looking at those signatures, and what are they comparing them to?
So we have our signature process is actually three parts. So what happens is when we bring them in, we send them through a machine very first, which pulls the data from the driver's license, or if we've updated signatures from other election mail, new registration forms, things like that. It goes through and it compares the signature on the envelope to that database, and then it will give us a report of this is what the machine thinks matches and what doesn't. So then the next process goes with the judges themselves, who have taken certifications. We make sure that they go through the motions, they get training, get certified, and then they look at that information, and then they decide if the machine was correct or not. And then at that point, if we still have challenged ballots, somebody that's actually a full-time county clerk employee, and we all have quite a bit of experience in my office, but that's the third part in the process, is that employee will do one last check to verify whether they agree with the challenge or not.
So if there is a challenge, if a vote a ballot does not pass through that third screen, what happens?
So at that point, we then send a letter to that voter to let them know that for whatever reason, either they didn't sign their ballot or we don't agree with the signature on the ballot, that it didn't match for whatever reason. And then they have an opportunity to get that back to us within a certain amount of time. So by law, they have to have it back to us 3 days prior to canvass. And our canvass date is always the two-week period. So it's actually 1 day. They have a little bit longer period of time to get it back to us this election period.
Okay, so in prior elections, how many ballots are typically subject to that kind of a challenge, where it's gone through the screen and you actually have to send out that letter?
On the third pass, so when we finally get to the end of the process, So I would say we're probably, last election it was high because we had new judges, so we're challenging a lot more. But this time, I think right now we have 700. We're at about 10% right now, but not all of those have gone through the third pass. So at the end, I would say we're probably around 5-10%.
So that's a significant number that are going to have to go through a process of validating the legitimacy of that ballot.
And we try really hard to, we don't want to inconvenience anybody, but we also want them, the voters, to know that we're trying to be very diligent in making sure people understand there is a process, and we want to make sure that they feel like we're actually watching for any fraud.
And how long after Tuesday will it take for you guys to post results?
So my goal this year is to have our partial completion around 9 o'clock. That gives us a little bit of time, because we will have people at the ballot boxes right at 8 p.m., which is, you know, the deadline for on election day. So it will take us a little while to process, make sure we have everybody back counted ballots, and then we should at that point be able to upload our first set of results.
And before we go, just what's the last day that people could safely put their mail? Is it too late to safely put your ballot in the mail now? Should they be taking them to drop boxes at this point?
Well, I mean, I can't really speak for the post office.
No.
Honestly.
Yes,
but the statute says you have to have your, if you're going to drop it in the mailbox, it has to be postmarked by 5 o'clock the day before election. So November 4th.
Okay, and as long as it's postmarked, you will actually, it'll end up in the final count even if it arrived a day or two late.
Yeah, so if it's postmarked and we receive it before Canvas, we do count them.
Okay, Joey, I know you've got a busy week coming up. Good luck with that, and thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the Yellow Lake fire is largely contained. When you get up in the morning, it doesn't sound like somebody's lit a campfire in your living room anymore. But the repair process has yet to begin. Here to explain that process is Forest Service PIO Brian Trick. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
So, can we first get a quick update on the actual status of that Yellow Lake fire? Is it completely contained? Where are we?
So it's not completely contained, and we did know that going into the weather that we had this week, and so we're about 70%, but we did plan on that. And so, yeah, certainly the weather and the snow has diminished really probably all activity that folks will see for a while. But we remain at 70% with suppression repair.
Now, I want to talk a lot about suppression repair this morning, but first, we always hear that term 70% contained. What does that really mean?
right. And so, yeah, and you'll probably see that number go up and down. So what that means is that fire managers believe that where we are calling the perimeter of the fire contained, that there is almost no risk or so of the fire going through that line. That doesn't mean, though, that the fire is not out. But what that means is that there's utter confidence that in that section, the fire should not jump that line.
So that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. That is actually a percent. It's almost more like you hear it, you think, okay, that's, you know, 7/10 of the circle is closed. But that's not really what it means at all. It's really more of a probability statement. It's 70% likely that it's going to stay in its box. Have I basically got that right?
That's exactly right. And so that's how you can see that number go down, is that it's a percentage of the total line. So if the fire has another big day and it grows 1,000 acres, that 70% will go down, given that it's a percentage.
And this has been going on for a long time. What is the size of the crew that's still working on it, and has the nature and composition of that crew changed as it's gone on?
Yes, yeah. So in fact, there's about one engine module that is on the fire, as well as a incident commander and a deputy incident commander. And that just goes to show just how much work has been accomplished. It went from a high of over 800 firefighters at the peak when we had that team in there. And really what they're doing now with the weather is, until they can really get in there and access some of these spots that are not contained, it's kind of that monitor status. And so that's where we're at, and they'll just continue to check those sections of line.
And the weather keeps them from going in there because it's too muddy? What can you explain what that means?
Yep, and that's exactly it. Okay. So it's more that as far as access goes, it's muddy, it is what it is, and also constantly traveling on those roads, we can even do more damage to it. And so if we are pretty confident that nothing is going to burn or extend from there, then, you know, we can other methods of checking and making sure the fire's.
Do they still
up.
Do aerial to look at it, or there's still helicopters and things like that checking on it?
So we don't have any aerial resources assigned to the fire at this time, but there were. Yep, and I wouldn't be surprised if when spring comes, we'll either do exactly that, given the size of the fire, be able to fly it and see any changes in the perimeter that may have happened over the spring.
Now, with a fire like this, will there still be at least minor activity for months?
Most likely, yeah. And fire is fascinating in that it could be buried under snow, and to a degree that snow becomes an insulator. And so underneath that snow, the duff or a root could still be burning. It can burn all through the winter. And then when it thaws and is wet and rains, it could still burn, and then we could have something come up.
That's pretty counterintuitive.
Right. Yeah, you would think, yeah. And so that's going to be the big part coming up is checking that 30% that's uncontained.
Okay, Brian, let's talk a little bit about suppression repair. What does that mean?
Yeah, so in the act of suppressing the fire, we have hand crews and large equipment, heavy equipment that will build fire line or containment line to stop the spread. Well, when we know that it's either done its job or it was a contingency, so meaning the fire never impacted it, we want to return that line to as natural a feature or to look as natural as possible. So literally what will happen is the hand crew may pull in the berm that they dug. They could even pull in some of the green and vegetation that they cut. And that's one to kind of just hide it and disguise it. But also it helps with erosion control. So if you think about digging a line straight up a hill, you could channelize water when melt or snow, snow melts or rain comes. So it also can break up that channelization of the water. Heavy equipment like a bulldozer is a little more involved. They'll usually dig what's called water bars, which are an angle, and it's a channel that's perpendicular to the hill slope. And again, it's to kind of take water off the side of the hill to break up maybe the speed and momentum of water and to prevent it from channelization and to reduce erosion.
So let's go back. The fire's burning hot. We're worried about it. Guys go in, men and women go in, they dig channels. Let's talk about what they did before mm-hmm. we talk about how to fix it.
Yeah, so fire line is pretty basic. It is a line dug to mineral soil. So if you come up to maybe a hillside, you've got everything, you've got the duff, you've got the grass, leaves and the larger trees even, and you look at that and you go, well, I need to get that down to mineral soil. So now you start cutting with chainsaws in front of the people. They start removing the brush, they maybe cut the logs that are dead and down. They might even have to fall a tree that's right on the line. And behind them are the people with hand tools. And they are literally just digging one hit, and they move. The guy or gal behind them hits and moves. And eventually, with about 18 or so people, you're going to get a line that is down to mineral soil that's a certain width.
How wide is that?
Yeah, so, and that'll depend on the fire behavior, but it's typically 3 to 5 feet.
So it's like a 3-foot ditch.
Pretty much.
That goes, when you say down to mineral soil, how deep is that?
So it could be anywhere from, very, very superficial to the surface, but in places like the Pacific Northwest, mm-hmm. it can be as deep as 3 feet.
Okay, yeah. So now I got this giant ditch, right, which as you say, if it's going down a hill, it's going to create a massive erosion problem.
Right.
So then I got to go back in with the same people and try to fill. I got to go undo what I worked so hard to do. That seems really frustrating.
It is, and all credit to the firefighters and the resources there that know how this works. That they went in there, they did their job, they stopped the fire. Now we ask them to completely reverse their work. But
Just to give people an order, an indication of the magnitude of what we're talking about, how many miles of this kind of stuff was there? How many ditches? For what's the better term? Fire lines.
Fire lines.
A real term.
Yep. So there's about 13 miles of hand line constructed, and I believe it was about 25 to 28 miles of dozer line. The dozer line is usually rehabbed by the dozer itself, goes a little faster. But yeah, they 100% of the hand line was rehabbed.
Already?
Yep.
Let's talk about when we talk about a dozer line, is that going deeper? That seems a lot faster. Like, I just drive a dozer, right?
It's actually a little more superficial. Yeah, it's not as deep as the hand line, but it is much wider.
Right.
Yep. And so it's a matter of just getting all that berm that the bulldozer pushed out.
They push it back.
Yep.
Now, just to sort of give people a perspective on this, a few years back we had a big fire over on 80, the Parley's fire, mm-hmm. right? If I went back there now, okay, would I still see the remnants of those lines, or would the remediation be such that it would almost be invisible?
So the lines themselves are probably largely invisible. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and really what you're seeing is the natural role the fire played. Really more than anything. So you see the dead trees, but you also see the grass and the shrubs and the forbs come back, that early succession. And so that's what we like to see. Mm-hmm. Suppression and repair line, not as much.
Okay, so I think you said that almost all the hand lines have been repaired. Most of the dozer lines already been repaired already?
Yes,
already. The fire's not out, you're already fixing it. That's extraordinary.
Right.
Okay. How long will it take to sort of finish this suppression repair?
Yeah, so... really what's going to happen is we're going to look at maybe the window that we do have with weather and see if we can get that last, I believe it's about 17 to 15% of the dozer line completed. And if we can't, if it's just not logistically feasible, we'll probably wait until the spring and the thaw. And again, we'll have to kind of assess, because granted that we did miss some, are we able to even rehab it right at this point, or has nature run its course? But likely we'll go back and reassess, and we will probably finish that up.
Do you do anything beyond, I mean, basically what we're talking about is putting the dirt back. I mean, for lack of a better term, right? I don't know, that's probably not the technical explanation. Do you do anything beyond that, like seeding or any other kinds of steps to sort of try to help nature get this back quickly, more quickly?
So there are those options, but actually our the conditions that we have on the forest as far as seed trees and things being able to just regenerate naturally, we typically don't. Some large fires, like in the West Desert, like in sagebrush and whatnot, that we will seed along with the Bureau of Land Management. But really, it's looking really good. And so we were able to get an assessment of burn severity, and if we have like less than 1% of severely burned, which means that we're pretty confident that nature will run its course and regenerate.
Now, do you do anything to like create mulch with some of this waste?
Yeah, So in places where the hand crews or the dozers themselves have pushed enough vegetation to kind of return it to that natural looking feature, so it's not just kind of an eyesore. We did have a chipper, and so around the Iron Mine Lake area, we chipped in around actually some of the camps, so the YMCA camp and the Paiute camp. That's also just to clean it up for next year for those scouts or those Girl Scouts or who have you.
They should go out and do that themselves. Isn't that what scouts are supposed to do?
right. They'll know what it's like to be a firefighter.
Okay, so you're with the National Forest?
I am.
Okay, so was this all National Forest land? Is that why this one falls squarely into your lap?
So it mostly was, yep. Okay. So very high percent, and again, I'd have to look at the exact percent. Yep. But so as far as jurisdiction, it was mostly the Forest Service, but when you get a team like we did, the Northern Utah Type 3 team and that California team, then it becomes just interagency and even inter-community. It's a pretty crazy thing in which the overhead are from everywhere, and we all work together, the state, municipalities, other federal agencies, and then the firefighters themselves are from all over. And so it really kind of, the lines blur, and we all have that one common objective.
Now, Brian, was this sort of the largest fire that you've had to deal with in terms of this area?
And so this was not only a surprise, given when it was in the season, but the size, it I believe was the largest fire in Utah this year. Mm-hmm. We saw those conditions, that an explosive growth, and it was kind of you maybe had a half second to react and realize, hey, this is going pretty big, but then of course you have a fire to put out and so manage it. And
I imagine there were some lessons learned. Will you guys do a session where you sit down and say, okay, what did we learn?
That's exactly it. Yep, we do an after action review. Okay. Yep, and so we'll see what went well and what didn't and improvements we can make, we'll be ready for the next one.
Okay, we've been talking with Brian Trick of the Forest Service. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me.
We'll be right back after this. It's high school football season, and the playoffs are on. Last week, we spoke to Park City High School coach Josh Monsingo about the minors season. The minors will be playing Bear River tonight at Dozier Field. It's a game we'll be carrying live here only on KPCW. Yesterday, I had the chance to speak to North Summit coach Jerry Holmes and Wasatch coach Jody Morgan about their upcoming playoff games. Here are those interviews. I'm on the phone with Jerry Holmes, the coach of the North Summit High School football team. We recorded this interview yesterday, but their playoff game is tonight. Jerry, how do things look?
Well, we're just excited to be in postseason time, and I think things look good for tonight. We are excited, and we had a week off last week, and so having that week off was good to heal up some bumps and bruises, but our kids are anxious to get playing a game again.
I was going to ask you about that. On the surface, it always looks like a bye week is an advantage, but did the kids get a little bit rusty during that week? How do you prevent that from happening?
Well, it's tough because there's not necessarily that focus on who your opponent is that Friday, and so we chose to take Monday off, and we took Friday off last week just to shorten that week up a little bit for the kids. So that was our answer for it. I don't know whether that's the right or wrong thing to do, but it worked, and this week's been a great week of practice, and I think we're ready to go.
So who are you playing tonight?
We play North Sevier, and we've played them earlier in the season, and so we beat them pretty handily, and so that's been probably the challenge of this week, is making sure that we're not overlooking and ready to play this quarterfinal game the way it should be played.
Yeah, I believe you beat them something like 55-27. And you guys are ranked number two, as I understand it. Why do you think you're not ranked number one if you beat the Beavers?
Well, the High School Activities Association uses a ranking system that it's their RPI, and it's not based on head to head. Whenever you do those, when you put numbers to it, it's your record plus your opponent's record, and even a small percentage goes to your opponent's opponent's records. And so those things are hard to control and hard for people to understand, but in the whole scheme of things, Beaver must have had a tougher schedule than we did, and they beat Grantsville, who has gone on to have a good record. So you play your schedule, and then you have to hope that everybody you beats everybody
does well,
else.
Right.
But I think that, you know, the fact is that we and Beaver are on opposite sides of the bracket, no matter who's one or two. But I would like to see us use the RPI as the starting point of where everybody lines up, and then maybe put the human factor back into it and say, well, let's look at head-to-heads and
right.
see if we can tweak things. But we're fine where we are.
I mean, one of the things about this team, as I understand it, is that you have a lot of players who stand out in different games, that there's not just one star, but you've got a really nice balance. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, we have a great group of seniors, and they've played together for a long time, and we've had some move-ins along the years, and it's just one of those special senior classes, and so many of them have really developed and matured over the years. Some of them have started for us since they were sophomores, and so they come with a lot of experience, and so you're right, we have a lot of guys that can shine and maybe shine a little brighter in one game, and then someone else does it the next game, and that's what makes us, I think, it's probably the reason we're 10-0, because
right.
we don't have just one guy that a team can really focus in on.
Now, when you have played a team before, there's a real advantage in looking at the tape, because you're not only looking at the other players, you're looking at how your players matched up with them. Is there anything you can share about how you might change things coming up for this game?
Well, you know, I think one of the advantages of having beaten a team is that the tendency is, well, we beat them doing what we did,
right.
So we'll just do that again. And then the advantage to the team that lost is they're looking for ways to adjust to try to make the game a better one. But we're approaching it, you know, in the sense of on defense, they had a few plays that probably gained more yards than we wanted them to. And so we just pinpointed specific plays that seemed to be their favorites and seemed to give us a little trouble. So that's what we focus on is where did we fall short a little bit when we played them the last time.
And I guess part of your job, I suppose, is to interface with the kids and potential college recruiters. Are some of your kids getting some interest this year?
Well, we do have our middle backer has been shown some interest, Buck Sargent. He plays tight end on offense and middle backer on defense. And he's just a big, tough kid. He's one of those that has started for us since he was a sophomore, and just has the structure physically that has caught the eye of some of the universities. So we're excited about that. But I can tell you right now, he's not even thinking about that. He's focused on his team and winning a state championship.
And we wish you luck in that. What time is the game tonight?
6 o'clock.
6 o'clock, and it's a home game, correct?
It is, yes.
All right. Well, thanks for spending time with us, and good luck tonight.
Hey, thank you very much.
I have on the phone Jody Morgan, the head coach of the Wasatch Wasps. Good morning. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Yourself?
Good. So now, Jody, this was your first year at Wasatch, wasn't it?
Yes, sir.
How has the transition been?
It's been great. The Wasatch community is great. Boys have been awesome. The coaching staff that was previously here has really bought into what we're doing, and so has the community, and it's been fun to be around.
So what is your background? Have you coached high school football before, and where did you come from?
Yeah, I grew up as a son of a high school football coach in the state of Utah, and then I coached in college for a little bit at Dixie State, or what is it now, Utah Tech, and went to Harriman as a coordinator, and then got a head coaching job at Riverton, and then now I'm at my dream job, Wasatch.
and I know last week you guys played a first-round game. Who did you play last week? And it was a higher-ranked team, so does that consider an upset?
Yeah, we played a higher-ranked team, but you know, due to our schedule this year, we have a really, really tough schedule. Our out-of-conference games, everybody besides one is still going. We felt like going into it that it was a pretty evenly matched game. It was going to be a tough game.
And who are you playing tonight?
Last week we played West Jordan. Mm-hmm. This week we play Brighton.
And how do you prepare your kids for a playoff game? I mean, to some extent, I know some of these teams had a bye last week, and I've heard arguments that in some ways you're better off not having a bye. How do you get the kids ready for a game like this?
Well, I mean, if you need to get them ready for a playoff game, you know, you should be a little concerned. It seems like that our boys last week and this week have been excited for the opportunity just to have one more week with each other. I mean, we all know what happens if you don't win that next game is for your seniors, most of them are not going to play football anymore. So it's just one more week, one more opportunity for us to be together.
Can you share with the audience identify some of the standout players on your squad?
Absolutely. We need to start with the D-line. We had two picks last week from our D-linemen, Brody Hume and Crew Baxter. Heath Budd, our other defensive lineman, had a pick earlier in the season. So the D-line has just played tremendous and tough. They played through a lot of injuries. They're a really fun group. They call themselves the Nasty Trench Hogs, which I think is funny. So, I got to start with them. And then our running backs really ran the ball hard and ran behind our best offensive lineman, Robbie Whalen, last week.
And tell me a little bit about the team you're playing tonight.
Brighton. Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a reason why they're ranked as high as they are. I believe that they've had 95 points scored on them all year.
Wow.
And they are really stout defensively. I know that they have some, you know, injuries at the quarterback position, but they are very tough at every position. I even think that the backup quarterback is a heck of an athlete.
Now, I guess one of your jobs includes sort of interfacing with those athletes who are being looked at by colleges. Are you seeing some recruiting activity on some of your kids this year?
Yeah, we're seeing a little bit. Definitely Robbie, the offensive lineman that I've mm-hmm. spoken of, he went to UNL, like a trip to UNLV
oh, wow.
in Northern Arizona and Montana State. Crew Baxter is our defensive lineman that I mentioned that got a pick last night, both juniors. He might be a valedictorian next year for our school, so he's going to get a lot of play with the academic schools, but he is more than capable to go to, you know, a big school. Heath Budd is working. We got Dylan Case working to, like, try to find a home. But other than Robbie, we haven't had a ton of in-person college recruiters coming here. We're kind of having to fight our way and try to find a home for our boys.
And I guess that's part of your job is to help those kids who are not getting all that attention. Go ahead, sorry.
Robbie and crew have been getting the most attention. Okay. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, how do you help kids who aren't sort of getting the attention? How do you help them bring themselves to the notice of college recruiters?
Well, one, I just think that unfortunately it's something that you have to teach boys. It's all about your effort and then understanding that it's outside of your control.
Yeah.
You need to do the best that you can do to get your best tape available and send it to as many coaches as possible. And it can't be, hey, you know, it's only these three schools. You are going against a lot of people, and you're going to have to spread your net far and wide if you want to play. If you're just saying, I'm only a player at these four schools, those scholarships are really rare. You can kind of see what's going on in college football right now is your top-of-the-line D1 schools aren't taking a lot of it. I mean, the transfer portal, I mean, everybody's going to talk about it till within, but who it really hurts is the high school player.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Now all of those scholarships are going to other college athletes, and now we're looking at, you know, an FCS scholarship is the equivalent of what used to be a D1 scholarship because, I mean, you look at Jack Kelly, who was at Kearns, then went to Weber State, played out there, and then now he's BYU's probably toughest defender. I mean, I don't know. All I'm saying is now the game has changed because of the transfer portal, and I think that has hurt the opportunities for high school kids to get a look at it at the next level.
If you're a college coach and you can recruit an experienced player, there's some advantage to that, obviously.
Right. Or, you know, I hope that more colleges probably go I know that they're not what they used to be, but, like, I like what Clemson does. Clemson says, hey, we're going to recruit you and we're going to develop you for 4 years. So if I was a college coach, coach of somebody that had to choose between those schools, I'd be like, hey, go to the guy that says he wants to coach you for 4 years, not the guy that, you know, I don't know. It's tough, man. I can see both sides of the argument, can't you?
Yes, I can. Okay, what time's the game tonight and where is it?
6 p.m. at the Jungle.
All right, so it's a home game for you guys?
No, the Jungle is where they play. They're the Tigers, brother.
Okay, 6 o'clock
at the Jungle. We would tell you the Nest.
There we go.
We would tell you the Nest.
All right. All right, thanks for spending time with us this morning, and good luck tonight.
Hey, I appreciate it.
Summit County government offices say they need more hands to perform their jobs. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports that new positions proposed in next year's budget show what areas are the most understaffed.
Their proposed 2025 budget reflects increased law and code enforcement needs across Summit County. The sheriff's office is asking for 4 new deputies and 5 school resource officers, the latter to comply with state mandate. The planning department wants 1 or 2 new code enforcers, and the attorney's office says it needs a paralegal and a prosecutor. Here's Summit County Manager Shane Scott.
We're focusing a lot on having some of the departments come and present ways in which they have gone through what we were calling the PPI process, the Peak Performance Initiative process, to make sure they're being as efficient as possible, that they have evaluated their personnel.
The sheriff's office tells the council it receives more than 5 times more calls now than it did 2 decades ago, but it still has the same number of sworn deputies responding to those calls. Sheriff Frank Smith has said that's a big deal because Summit County has seen big cases, particularly in the past year.
It's changed quite a bit, and I never thought we'd have a shooting in Browns Canyon like we had. I never thought we would see, you know, the homicides that we see.
The Summit County Attorney's Office is prosecuting a particularly high-profile alleged murder. A Camas mother of 3, Corey Richens, is accused of fatally poisoning her husband 2 years ago. That case in particular has strained prosecutors' resources, County Attorney Margaret Olson has previously told the council.
Pre-COVID, we had 6,155 cases. We're on track this year to have almost 9,000.
Both of those offices are bigger than code enforcement. There are just 2 officers to enforce planning and zoning rules in a county of nearly 43,000. Community Development Director Peter Barnes has said they're effective but busy. They've been called upon in the Snyderville Basin this year for everything from unlicensed businesses to illegal short-term rentals. The planning department wants an officer dedicated to building inspections and another expressly for short-term rentals. Park City and Summit County have gained more STRs than anywhere else in Utah since 2021. County staff say they can fund all these positions if a sales tax, Proposition 18, passes. So the council is awaiting the results of Tuesday's election before contemplating cuts. Otherwise, council members will need to decide between new employees and a property tax hike. They deferred a tax increase last year with cuts and haven't raised taxes in the county's main fund in 7 years. Summit County has the second lowest tax rate in Utah, but some of the highest property values. The county manager says the proposed budget does not include 20 other new employees other offices requested. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
You've been listening to the Local News Hour. Don't forget to tune in to hear the Park City Miners playoff game tonight against Bear River at 6 o'clock.